Nearly 3 years ago, two college professors' fantasy became a reality in a form repeatedly seen before, a small podcast. The motivation for spending their honoraria to create the podcast was to encounter old works of international relations theory, which could be called artistic creations. To realize their dream, they secretly started choosing the top whiskeys of moderate price and named their show Whiskey and IR Theory. Every podcast, reputations are on the line over Zoom, where Patrick Jackson pits whiskeys against books and articles. What inspiration does today's subject bring? And how long will Patrick and Dan Nexon talk for? The Theory will be on. A long time since we've done one of these.
It has. It's sort of like riding a bicycle, except it's like having not ridden a bicycle for months, and so you're kind of wobbly. So I'm like, where do things go? Like, just physically, where do you position things on the desk? Yeah, happening to get back into the habit of how we do this.
You know, and the fact is, I've been doing these whiskey optionals, which are a lot less work for me. I don't have to do much in the way of preparation.
But I guess
we need to get back to our bread and butter, and this is it. Do you have a whiskey selection? Because it's not that, it's a little bit earlier than we normally do this, and I'm in my office and I don't have any whiskey.
So it is early, but of course I have whiskey.
Excellent.
And it's not so much whiskey that is linked to Goldsworthy Lowes Dickinson himself as much as history of IR puts me in the mind of thinking about 1919 as one of the hypothetical big bang points for when IR and international affairs generally are supposed to completely change. And one of the people who has railed against this in print is our good friend Halvard Lera. And Halvard was visiting earlier this summer and brought me a bottle of High Coast single malt peated whiskey, which is actually from Sweden. So it is Swedish whiskey, and it's been sitting upstairs in my living room for a few weeks. And this seems like as good an occasion as any to pop that open. It is High Coast Timmer, peat smoke, Swedish whiskey. Now I'm going to open it up and pour myself a dram. I'm sorry that you are unable to have any whiskey because you are needing to drive home later. One day we need to do this in person again so you can come and help me drink some of the whiskey that is accumulated in my house. So
I've been advocating that for a while, just saying.
So perhaps the next one, when we do one next month, we should actually do this in person. Oh, that smells lovely.
I don't know how successfully I ultimately edited those early episodes that we did do in person, but we were pretty shit-faced by the end of those.
A lot of alcohol was consumed.
Yeah.
I'll put that creatively in the passive voice. Yes.
Let me
put
it this way. We were quite drunk.
And that is something we should probably watch a little bit.
You say this like it's a bad thing.
Yeah, well, it depends on what our listeners are interested in, I suppose. Oh, that is lovely. It's very delicate. Reminds me in some ways of like a, almost like a Connemara, an Irish peated. Interesting.
So how would you describe it for people who don't have the reference to the other whiskeys, right? For whom the analogy is not useful.
Right, right. So it's very bright. And it has kind of a salty aftertaste. Not as complex peaty as, like, say, an Ardbeg or something. It's a little more of a gentle peat, and not a lot of heavy sherry in it. Is in weird ways kind of reminiscent of some Ardbegs, although nowhere near as peaty or as complicated. got a very interesting citrus thing up front too, almost orangey, and that kind of fades.
So do you have any way to tie this into the readings for today?
Except for the strangely convoluted pathway of let's think about the history of international studies and whether 1919 was actually a big breakpoint or not. No, I really don't have any other way to tie it in. It's the whiskey of convenience. It is the one that has been staring at me on my shelf for several weeks now.
Today we are going to be talking about G. Lowes Dickinson. We are going to be focusing on some pages out of The European Anarchy, but you and I have both read, between us, a good portion of his works at this point.
Yes, and he was reasonably prolific, although not in international studies. He actually only wrote a few things that were specifically related to what we would later come to think of as international studies or IR. Most of his work is actually in classics, in some philosophy. He wrote plays. This was a literate English gentleman of the time, right? So he's written a whole bunch of stuff. And among other things, I've had occasion to read his lecture on the desirability of immortality, which he gave at the invitation of what was apparently, I don't know if this still exists, but there was an endowed lecture series at Harvard that was about the immortality of man. And Dickinson was one of the people who was invited to come and give a lecture in that particular series. His best known book is actually this thing called The Greek View of Life, which is one of the early, late 19th, early 20th century examples of the reverence for the Greeks as a certain kind of pre-Christian pagan ideal. And Dickinson is one of the people who is really adamant about advocating this Greek style of things. So much so that when G.K. Chesterton is writing his book on various heretics, one of the people he chooses to single out is Goldsworthy Lowes Dickinson for his view of paganism, and is not happy about the way that Dickinson's trying to reinvent paganism as a desirable thing, more desirable than contemporary Christianity. So this is someone who was reasonably prominent in a variety of intellectual spheres, and I would say is only kind of tangentially and by circumstance interested in international relations. The circumstance, of course, being World War I, which is a large circumstance, but that's what seems to pull him in. And then he spends some time working on these sorts of issues after that. But it's not like if you'd looked at his career trajectory from up to about 1910, 1912, you wouldn't see international relations in his future at all.
Now, my understanding is that he grew up a Christian socialist. And it's very obvious, at least from the material I've read, I focused almost entirely on his international relations work. I didn't, unlike you, read some of the stuff outside of that silo. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty clear that he retained at least a good deal of the socialism.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But the question is whether he retained the Christianity, I suppose.
And he really doesn't. He retains certain kinds of universal brotherhood type values, but thinks that those are better expressed through pagan and particularly Greek understandings than they are through Christianity. So he's someone who is not doctrinally committed, certainly, to Christianity. But I think you're absolutely right. The socialism stays part of, and it's funny because E.M. Forster wrote a biography of him. And in Forster's biography, one of the points that is continually stressed is how much Dickinson, or apparently he was called Goldie to his friends, how much his sort of elite educational sensibilities were just horrified by the war, and how devastating it was to see these horrible acts of violence going on. And it really led him to look for something different than the current situation, because obviously what had been going on was unable to restrain all of this violence. And he had a lot of friends who died during the war, like I think a lot of folks did at that time. And this is hugely traumatic for him. And I think in order to understand the context of his writings on international studies, we have to understand him as someone who had a kind of elite socialist brotherhood of man view that was then shattered by the First World War. And a lot of what he's trying to do then is to understand what happened during that time.
It's funny because today in my undergraduate seminar, actually first year seminar, which I'm calling Foundations of International Thought, largely reading some classics and some not classics and things I want to read. Mm-hmm. You get the basic idea there. Yep. We actually read Of the Culture of White Folk Today.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, it was an interesting discussion. And, you know, we walked through the causal. This is W.E.B. Du Bois. For those of you who don't know it, it's in the Journal of Race Development, which was the first name of the journal that became Foreign Affairs. The interesting thing about that is that I had to simultaneously communicate to my students both what a cognitive and cultural shock the First World War was for Europeans, but also in the context of W.E.B. Du Bois' argument that it shouldn't be a cultural shock because that's just what you've been doing to everybody else for quite some time.
Right. Right. And I think that Dickinson's reaction is a pretty good barometer of that, because he's an elite educated Briton, right? He's someone who grows up, as you said, in this sort of Christian socialist household. He went to Charterhouse, which is an elite public school. So it's not Eton, but it's close. And, you know, fun fact, he went to Charterhouse. So did the original members of Genesis, which is my connection to Charterhouse. So Dickinson went to Charterhouse and then went from there on to Cambridge and was, you know, one of these English intellectual elites who just kind of moved around. He was an apostle. He's what a member of that debating society that John Maynard Keynes is eventually a member of, and also Wittgenstein is later a member of, although they can't quite overlap because of their difference in age, where Dickinson is not really active in that group by the time Wittgenstein is starting to be part of it. But you know, he's an elite British intellectual who dabbles in literature and philosophy and the classics and so on. He's a pretty unreflective liberal imperialist, right? There's a British Empire, and the British Empire is generally a force for good in the world, and people are getting more civilized. And as they become more civilized, then they will be able to join the family of nations, right? So he's exactly the sort of person for whom Du Bois's argument is quite insightful. Like, it shouldn't be a surprise, but it is when the First World War happens.
You know, it's funny because there are passages in The Causes of International War, which is from 1920, mm-hmm. where he's a little bit more skeptical of the British Empire, or at least imperialism in general. Mm-hmm. It's kind of worth noting.
Yeah, I think certainly by his really stuff that's much later, but in his essay, the 1914 essay that appeared in the Atlantic, he's much more keen on, okay, the British Empire is not the source of the problem here. But of course, that all goes back to the main argument, right? Which is that the First World War is not ultimately the result of anything domestically happening within particular countries, that it has to do with a broad practice of, I mean, wouldn't use this language, but a broad practice of international anarchy. And that's kind of what brings the war to fruition, as opposed to, you know, he spends a lot of time criticizing, as opposed to the evil of the Huns or the backwardness of Russia or whatever. And he says, no, those aren't actually the reasons why we have the war.
So listeners should know that the reason we decided to read specifically the European Anarchy, but also some of his other work, is that during these debates about Ukraine, Paul Post wrote a piece at Foreign Affairs where he basically said, you know, look, realism is pretty cool, even if you disagree with Mearsheim. Right? I mean, it was something to that effect. I mean, I don't really know if that's an accurate description, but, you know, it's sort of defending the realist tradition and pointing out that it's much larger than Mearsheimer. And there he invokes Dickinson as the first kind of person to identify the modern realist argument. That is, that international anarchy is the source of war. He is getting that from Mearsheimer, who cites him, name checks Dickinson at the very beginning of The Tragedy of Great Power Politics as, you know, sort of a good brief for the argument, even though he doesn't make the full offensive realist argument. So Mearsheimer is still justified in writing The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. And there were reasons to believe that that might not quite be right. Jack Donnelly, who's been very critical of the idea that anarchy is the organizing tradition of the study of international relations, in his international theory piece critiquing the centrality of anarchy, he reads Dickinson and some other people who show up in these debates and says, you know, they're not really talking about exactly the same thing. They mean something. They seem to mean something different by anarchy, or at least somewhat different than what the realists talk about. I went back and I was just kind of interested. So, you know, is he the first person to articulate this argument? So I did what I always do, which is I did a deep dive into the Google Books archive. And I found a number of people from the 19th century also blaming war on anarchy, although in an even less developed way than you have in the European anarchy, where he spends, what, 8 pages laying out the argument?
Mm-hmm.
Although it percolates through the entire book, which is a good deal longer than 8 pages. And then, you know, the other day I was teaching in the same course I mentioned where we read W.E.B. Du Bois for today. We read Kant recently, and there again, you know, Kant in Perpetual Peace is ascribing the war to some degree to anarchy. Right? Part of the reason we need a federation of republics or a republic of republics or a league of nations is to do away with the pernicious effects. So this is clearly a very old tradition. Regardless of what we mean by anarchy, something like anarchy, or arguing that international politics is anarchical or is something like the state of nature, and that this is at least a contributory cause to war, seems to have a much longer tradition. It clearly dates back before World War I. And as I think we'll talk about later, seems to be almost exclusively associated with reformers, people who believe in projects like World Federation or projects like a League of Nations. And it's precisely because they ascribe war to a condition that we can get rid of it.
Right, right, exactly. And Dickinson, the only thing I had heard of Dickinson before doing this particular dive for this episode was that I knew his name as someone who was a strong advocate for the formation of the League. So it struck me as a little bit weird that anybody would be citing somebody who was a strong advocate for the formation of the League, and not so much an advocate within scholarly circles as a public advocate, right? He was somebody who was active in the campaign for the League. It struck me as odd that someone like that would be claimed by contemporary realists as some sort of ancestor, because as we remember from taking classes with Robert Jervis years and years ago, the League of Nations is one of the favorite things for the realists of the world to beat up on and say, look how silly, look how ridiculous these states were that they thought they could come together and cooperate and then ban war and so on. And so someone who was a strong League advocate being roped into the realist tradition just struck me as a little bit odd.
Well, this goes back to some of the discussions we've had about structural realism in the past. We're very fond of invoking Keith Shimko's article. This is, where was it? It was, I can look
was
it up.
Was it in ISQ?
No, it was.
No, it was in some other strange place.
I wanted to say Review of International Studies, but it's not.
No. Keep talking. I'll Google it.
We've invoked Keith Shimko's article on anarchy and structural realism before, and Shimko's argument, in essence, is that by moving from a human nature-centric account of realism, you know, kind of if you think about the German Realpolitik tradition, or as particularly as brought over by Morgenthau, you have a notion that the reason why power politics is inevitable is that human beings are power-seeking by their nature. So they have a will to dominate, or they suffer from original sin if you're using Niebuhr or whomever. The argument that Shimko makes is that that sits very uneasily with the liberal American tradition. And here he's doing the kind of Louis Hart's liberalism, the irrational Lockeanism. Some, you know, at heart, Americans buy into certain kinds of liberal presumptions about the way the world works. And so what Shimko argues is that Waltz solves this problem by shifting the blame for war, conflict, power politics away from some innate feature of human nature, or even of state ideology, and onto international anarchy, which makes it therefore compatible with liberalism. And I think we have always really liked this argument. But what I'm increasingly getting the sense of from having read some of these 19th and 20th century accounts that focus on anarchy as the cause of war, going back and rereading Kant in that light, is that it's always been a liberal argument, or it's always been a left argument. And so maybe it's not really even, you know, this is something that Paul Post and I got into, where I think maybe Paul's right to some degree that he says Carr isn't a realist. And I was saying, well, he's a realist in the way that we understand realism today. He's not a realist in the way that Carr understood the German realpolitik tradition. Mm-hmm. But now I'm starting to think, you know, maybe it just makes sense to call most modern realists pessimistic liberals. In essence, they buy a certain set of liberal assumptions about the causes of war. They're just skeptical of the ability to form global governance regimes that can prevent it, that can work. Mm.
Mm. And certainly from the structure of a lot of Dickinson's arguments, you can see there's a logical gap where a skeptic could sort of drive right through, because Dickinson and many of his writings on World War I seem to take this form. There are meticulous documentations of all of the things that led up to there being a war. And then there's like a break. And then there's and the solution is a League of Nations. And there's no real attention given to how you would get to a League of Nations. It's just, this is what we need. We need a League of Nations. We need to stop the governmental philosophy, or the, what is it, in European anarchy, he starts off by blaming Machiavelli, right? Like, it's Machiavelli's fault. And everybody became a Machiavellian, and therefore we are stuck in this anarchy, and there we go. But there's not really a sense of how we would kind of get to that. So I suppose a skeptical realist could take a look at this, or someone who is skeptical of this could look at it and say, ah, okay, we buy the first 85% of the argument about the causes of war. We don't buy the solution. So.
And this gets.
Oh, and Shimko's piece, by the way, apparently appeared in the Review of Politics.
Right.
Which is why we never remember where it appeared.
I mean, just on that note, before we get into the European anarchy itself, I think we have some answers to that. And the answers are contained in what you've already said, which is that Jack Donnelly is right that when somebody like, certainly when Dickinson talks about the European anarchy or the international anarchy, he is not talking precisely about anarchy as an ordering principle in the way that realists talk about. Doesn't seem to me. There are times when you can see it, you could see that interpretation, but there are times where it really doesn't seem to fit. What's interesting to me was that, so right before we started, I did finally go through the Causes of War 1920 book called International, it's the International Relations series edited by G. Lowes Dickinson, and it's The Causes of War by G. Lowes Dickinson from 1920, from London, right. The Swarthmore Press Limited in New York, Harcourt, Brace, and Howe. And in this, what's interesting about this piece is that he's already kind of soured on what's going on with the League of Nations. Mm. He's particularly upset because of the punitive nature of the piece, the way in which they resort to old-fashioned 19th century power politics. So he talks about using Yugoslavia, spelled J-U-G-O hyphen Slavia, and Czechoslovakia, the mm-hmm. way that they constitute these two artificial powers to hem in Germany. Mm-hmm. For example, and he says this is kind of the old, same old, same old power political game. So he's a little bit, he's kind of not too happy about this stuff. And he says right. There's all this hostility to the League, and that's going to be a problem. And what he winds up doing is blaming, it's a class argument. It's the military class, the professional class, the rich, they're the source of the problem, the imperialists in particular.
Right.
They are all examples of imperialists, and it's their attitude, their disposition, which makes something like the League Project difficult, and we need to overcome them if we want to be able to make the League work the way that it should. And he even talks about the fact that the League's been adapted to serve the interests of imperialism, something that Mark Mazower, No Enchanted Palace, was an entire argument about this, right? The League as a being complicit with imperialism and design.
Right, right.
It's pretty obvious, and, apparently, at the time.
Oh yeah, and you know, one of the more striking factoids about Dickinson that I got from reading Forster's biography is that sort of the last straw for Dickinson when it came to the League was, or one of the last straws, which I think contributes to this disillusion that you're talking about, is that he was a strong advocate that League educational programs to coordinate universities and scientific advancements and so on ought to include Germany as an equal player. And when he proposed that, he was roundly castigated by other members of the British delegation for being a traitor. And he did not take well to this. So I think, if anything, he can be accused of not appreciating the extent to which these, what he calls the governmental mind, governmental mentality, or the governmental theory, the anarchic mindset, is connected with these very powerful interests in some of his earlier writing. But certainly his experience throughout does lead to him backing off from some of the earlier claims about how easy it would be to change this.
Yeah, I mean, I think I sort of interpret some of this as, you know, he's writing The European Anarchy in, what, 1916, 1917?
Mm-hmm.
And he's looking forward to the end of the war. And I think it's not unreasonable, you know, to think that, you know, this is pretty cataclysmic. This is a pretty big shock. It's pretty obviously awful. And maybe this will be the kick in the pants we need. And I don't think that, you know, I'm not sure, you know, we look back and we sort of think there's this air of inevitability that it was bound to fail. And there's a question about whether the League really failed, which is an entirely separate matter. But, you know, I don't think it's completely unreasonable. I mean, I think that often our hopes are disappointed about, you know, humanity coming out of some similar crisis and doing the right thing, but it's not possible. I mean, there was a lot that came out of World War II, at least in Europe, that was in Western Europe, that was productive. All right, so let me see. There, some stuff came out of World War II that I think has stuck. Let me put it that way. Just to give you a sense of what he sounds like when he's talking about, you know, in this 1920 book, but this conclusion is unwelcome, if not intolerable, to the governing classes of all nations, and not least to that of this country. Their tradition, their education, their pride, their interest all work against it. The imperialism of the wealthy and aristocratic sections of the English of the army, the navy, the church, the public schools, to a great extent the universities, is so direct, so simple, so unamenable to discussion and argument as to resemble an instinct. There is no evidence that the war has done anything to it except to enhance it. As to the League of Nations, these classes either are frankly hostile to it, or they regard it as a device to consolidate the empire by stabilizing the status quo after it has been made as favorable as possible to British power. While this kind of spirit animates governing classes, the League simply cannot function. It is the sense of this irreconcilable hostility of the governing class to the only conditions that can give us a world at peace that is leading so many people to turn, for their only hope, to labor. A hope it is, but not a certainty. For as we have noticed in a previous chapter, the passions, good and bad, of the peoples make them easy dupes of imperialism. Their leaders, indeed, in all countries see the truth clearly, but it must be doubted whether the rank and file do. A great work of education has here to be done. Internationalists must contend with imperialists for the mind and soul of the people. Imperialists have at their disposal the money, the press, the innumerable agencies of corruption and intrigue. Above all, they have, if they choose, one great bribe to offer. They may go to the working class and say, "We offer you a tribute empire. Black men, yellow men, brown men shall slave throughout the world to give you cheap raw materials. We will share the spoils with you. Honestly, we will. We will all grow rich together at the price of their poverty. Let us stop this idle, wasteful fighting with one another. Let us join hands to exploit our subject peoples."
Yeah. Yeah. Now, which book is that from again?
It's from The Causes of International War, which is, this remedy section actually goes on to discuss the purpose of the series being to create along a public forum for ideas about international politics, and that we have at our, he says, we have, you know, we internationalists have at our disposal, you know, public forums.
Right? So this is the post-war work, right? This is the 1926 or something.
I thought it was 1926, but the imprint is 1920.
Interesting. Okay, so it's earlier than I thought.
So it's really soon. After
really soon afterwards. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I feel like I need to slightly amend the comment I was making earlier about his imperial sentiments. He's certainly opposed to the continuation of the empire in a way that links it to this international anarchy, to the squabbling between European sovereigns for power by grabbing other parts of the world. But ultimately, he's still, if you want to call that like a capital I imperialist, he's opposed to that. But he's certainly not a critic of empire the way someone like Du Bois was. So he does ultimately think that there is a kind of tutelage function that some of these countries of the world now can sort of grow up into and join the system. And in a weird way, it sounds an awful lot like some of the things you read in Headley Bull about the expansion of international society. It's that same kind of like genteel British understanding of the way that international politics is supposed to work. If we could get past the folks who would stay in power by rallying the masses and fighting pointless wars, right? So that's kind of the idiom that someone like Dickinson is in.
But it's very clear from this book that at least as of the time of its writing, he is soured on a lot of that.
Yeah.
He has a whole section in War Between States on where he just goes after the idea of civilization. He says, by civilization is meant a state of things better than that which preceded the conquest, and it must be worked to begin with that not all conquests are in the sense civilizing. Nobody thinks that the conquest of the Huns or the Turks were. Many doubt whether the conquest of the Roman Empire by the barbarian was. History perhaps will take a different view of the conquest of Africa and Asia by the West from that which the West itself generally takes now. Hmm. To praise the good and the evil involved in these great world events is perhaps beyond any human capacity. It certainly cannot be attempted here in a parenthesis. But what must be said, because it is true and relevant, is that never has any state made any conquest in order to benefit the people concerned and not in order to benefit itself. The motives for conquests have invariably been those outlined in the previous pages. Later on, no doubt, a sense of responsibility to the conquered is sometimes developed, and much has been done which may fairly be regarded as disinterested, whether or no it has been beneficial. But if and when that has happened, it does not affect our analysis. States conquer by war in order to secure or extend their power. Were otherwise, every state would be as much pleased to see backward races being civilized by other states as by themselves. Are they, in fact? Has any state ever looked with satisfaction on the annexation of any territory by another state, even though, according to all the current assumptions, it should be to the advantage of the natives concerned to be thus civilized by force? So you're right. Yeah. I mean, this is not Du Bois saying, you white people are a bunch of barbarian hucksters who don't understand that, you know, you delude yourselves into thinking that you're better than us when you're certainly no better and you're probably at least now worse.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that, but it is in the general kind of orbit or ambit of this kind of left-wing position where imperialism is caught up with the causes of the war and where imperialism is very much kind of a, you know, in some respects is about reconciling the classes to capitalism, bringing the working classes along and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah. And distributing spoils and distracting people from the rapacious character of the governing classes. I mean, one of the things that's the most fun to read, I think, in Dickinson is precisely when he skewers some of these purported reasons that people give for why there were wars. And he says, well, no, actually, it's not any of this stuff. What does he say? Actually, this is in European Anarchy. Whatever be the diversities of opinion that prevail in the different countries concerned, nobody pretends that the war arose out of any need of civilization, out of any generous impulse or noble ambition. It arose, according to the popular view in England, solely and exclusively out of the ambition of Germany to seize territory and power. And it arose, according to the popular German view, out of the ambition of England to attack and destroy the rising power and wealth of Germany. Thus, to each set of belligerents, the war appears as one forced upon them by sheer wickedness, and from neither point of view has it any kind of moral justification. These views, it is true, are both too simple for the facts. But the account given in the preceding pages, imperfect as it is, shows clearly what further knowledge will only make more explicit, that the war proceeded out of rivalry for empire between all the great powers in every part of the world. So there is, and that to me, when I read that section, what it immediately sounds like, it sounds like the Union for Democratic Control. It sounds like some of the things coming out of Norman and Jell. It sounds like this idea that if the people could simply control foreign policy through some democratic means and take it away from the rapacious elites, then you would have peace.
So we should get into the book proper. The edition that I'm using is from 1917, and it's the American edition.
Okay.
That was the one that I downloaded through Google Books. It's free in a variety of things. Do you know what edition you were using?
Hold on. Let me check and see which edition I was using. So the edition that I have is, let's see, it's a public domain book. It was scanned in by somebody or another. And it is not, it's just text. It's not really laid out in PDF. Okay. So the copyright on it is 1916.
So that's probably the first edition, or it's the British edition. Because
probably.
The American, what's interesting about the American edition is that it opens with "Forward to the American Edition."
That I have not read.
And he writes, "These pages were written in the hope that they might be read and considered by the more reasonable section of the British public. They are likely at the present moment to find more response in America than in England." He goes on to say that Americans may be sympathetic to the Allies and they understand a German victory would be very bad for them, but they also recognize that no military victory or defeat can of itself secure that durable peace by which alone democratic liberties can be assured and developed. The whole system of international relations must be transformed by a deliberate act of policy if this result is to be achieved. States must combine not in temporary alliances and counter-alliances pregnant with new wars, but in a union to develop the law of nations to sustain it against lawbreakers. Forwards are always going to flatter their audience, but I do think it is interesting for him to argue that there is something about the spirit of American political culture which will make it more amenable to a just peace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether or not that's actually true. Certainly, I think Wilson was, for all of his problems, more interested in that at Versailles.
Reading Dickinson also, it puts me in the light of, it puts me in mind of a book that I know we're fond of, Frank Mankiewicz's Power and Modernity, in which he looks very carefully at that kind of Wilsonian approach and ties it into notions about the public and faith in the public and the way that the United States sets itself up as the last best hope of mankind to hear what the people actually have to say. And if you could just get rid of the elites and their secret treaties, then you would be, you know, you'd be in a much better place. So there is something, it's not just Wilson. There's a broad kind of exceptionalist narrative here about listening to the people and creating a new order by getting past these warring elites.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's important about this is the way that it's characterized, and Dickinson very clearly characterizes it this way. These are changeable attitudes rather than parametric structural constraints. These are ways that people could choose to act differently and they don't. And that's why they need to be replaced with something else. And I think you can see some of that in, maybe not specifically, maybe not just in Woodrow Wilson himself, but certainly in what has been known and come down to us now as Wilsonianism, is a way of getting past elites by appealing to the people, the naturalization of nations wanting to belong together and saying, okay, well, you can sort of solve problems if you just give people more democratic control over these things.
As you were saying that, I was just thinking that John Eikenberry and Dan Dudney are probably correct to characterize the post-war settlement as Rooseveltian. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say that Wilson is invoked, and certainly there are continuities, but that the invocation of the continuities is in part a legitimation project.
Yes.
Not just a kind of template. So the European Anarchy is about 150 pages in the version that I have. It's got 19 chapters. And essentially, the stuff that you would read as an IR theorist is all like in the first, 17 pages?
Yeah, yeah. It's the first. It's basically the first chapter, and then a little bit of the last chapter, and then the rest of it is a detailed sort of blow-by-blow reconstruction of the way of the different policy decisions that Powers made. So, yeah.
And interspersed among those other things, he advances the argument in various ways, or has, you know, interesting kinds of asides, interesting claims. But really, it is this beginning. So maybe we should look at that in more detail.
Yeah. I think it's a good idea.
And as you mentioned earlier, he opens with the notion that in the great and tragic history of Europe, there is a turning point that marks the defeat of the ideal of a world order and the definite acceptance of international anarchy. That turning point is the emergence of the sovereign state at the end of the 15th century. And that is where then Machiavelli is both a kind of symbolic figure and an animating spirit of what's so terrible.
Yep.
From that date onward, international policy has meant Machiavellianism. Sometimes the masters of the craft, like Catherine de Medici or Napoleon, have avowed it. Sometimes, like Frederick the Great, they have disclaimed it, but always they have practiced. Right out of the gate, sovereign states means anarchy, means Machiavellianism / realpolitik / power politics. It's bad. I do find it interesting that he dates the sovereign state to the end of the 15th century, which I think is not necessarily what the consensus is right now. I think the consensus is there is no birthing moment of sovereignty. But I think it's certainly a better dating than 1648. You can tell a sort of consistent story that by that period, you have, even if the states themselves are nothing like national states, that you do have sovereigns claiming prerogatives that are the autonomous ability to make their own. And Philippa puts it, there's one last gasp of universalist spirit under Charles V. But that's a short-lived propaganda campaign, which turns out to be more useful for his enemies to propagandize against him than it is for him to build the case for his hegemony in Europe. So it is, as you say, fascinating because he makes arguments that sound a lot like realism, but he doesn't like the condition. When Mearsheimer, it's a tragedy with a kind of nudge, wink, wink, you know, I'm a hardcore realist. For Dickinson, it is a tragedy.
No, he is in no way fond of this. And what's interesting is the ambiguity of what he thinks causes this. Because in the account in the European Anarchy, I could see where you might read this as there's a deep organizing principle of anarchy and we can do nothing else, right? Because the bit that you just read, he says, you know, they could not indeed practice anything else. It is as true as an aggregation of states as of an aggregation of individuals that whatever moral sentiments may prevail, if there is no common law, no common force, the best intentions will be defeated by lack of confidence and security.
You should read the rest of that passage because it is like a gold mine for contemporary IR theorists.
Oh, yeah. So mutual fear and mutual suspicion, aggression masquerading as defense, and defense masquerading as aggression will be the protagonist in the bloody drama. There will be what Hobbes truly asserted to be the essence of such a situation, a chronic state of war, open or veiled, for peace itself will be a latent war, and the more states armed to prevent a conflict, the more certainly will it be provoked, since to one or another it will always seem a better chance to have it now than to have it on worse conditions later, which, gosh, security dilemma, anyone?
It's not just the security dilemma. He actually gets Hobbes right there.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, there's just a lot. It's just a very smart articulation.
But what I find interesting is that's the version that he has in European Anarchy in 1916, right? So in 1914, December 1914, issue of The Atlantic, the article called The War and the Way Out, he refers to this same situation, but he refers to it as the governmental theory and argues that the problem is that leaders operate with this theory and that's what creates these difficulties, and that plain ordinary people think about things differently, and if they were in charge of foreign policy, you wouldn't end up having this. That's not quite the same account as you've got in 1916, because in 1916, it doesn't appear so much to be an attitude as a kind of inevitable consequence of something that you might, if you were kind of squinting at it, think of as an organizing principle?
It is an organizing principle for him, but it's not immutable. And that's the key thing, is that he doesn't think that you can't get out of it. So it doesn't have the same force that it often has in structural realist theory, where it is not just a barrier. You know, it's not just that anarchy is a permissive condition for war, or that anarchy encourages security dilemmas, or that anarchy encourages power maximization, depending on what kind of realist you are. It's that it also prevents the kind of cooperation necessary to ameliorate those dynamics. Certainly, if you're in the offensive realist camp, in the defensive realist camp, it ameliorate, you can sort of get partial stuff going on, but you can't really escape it. But this book, it's not just the article, this book only makes sense if Dickinson believes that these are dispositions that can be overcome given the right conditions. And it's interesting because I will say that he says that, you know, this kind of will continue until there's either, you know, either we get empire, basically, that's where this ends up, or we get a common law and a common authority is established by a group. And he then makes the argument that Great Britain has indeed been unusual in that it hasn't sought universal domination on the continent. But he says, you know, so it's been a balancer. It's been the only one who's committed to the principle of balance of power. But but for him, that's just out of self-interest, right? Not something to pat ourselves on the back for. It doesn't make us better than anybody else. Although he does make the claim that since the 15th century, Britain has not had, she's never menaced the continent, and that's just not true. Henry VIII's wars with Charles against Francis, those wars, that one of the outcomes that Henry is talking about is partition. So I don't know if that's entirely accurate, and I suspect that there have been British heads of state who have thought about European expansion at one time or another.
But there is still that kind of, you know, Britain, the offshore balancer, is an important piece of the British identity that seems to run through this. So he does, and it's interesting because it's interesting that later he returns to the United States for this, but he almost seems to see that maybe Britain could be the power that helped get past this international anarchy, but then no, it's really going to be the United States. Right? It's really going to be somebody who's sort of even further outside the system who can come in and kind of think about this a little bit differently. And Britain does not emerge from his overall account looking, it looks maybe a little better than some of the other European states, but it certainly doesn't look great. So.
Yeah, he's going to go, I mean, he goes on and says, you know, but Europe's not the only theater. Since the 16th century, the Europeans have also been striving for mastery over the globe. Right. And you know, this suits England really well. Essentially, offshore balancing is a great deal if you're expanding elsewhere. Great Britain reaps the reward of her European conflicts in the empire, wrongly so-called, on which the sun never sets. Next to her comes France and Africa in the east, while Germany looks out with discontented eyes on a world already occupied. Now, I think it is useful to kind of try to pick out here, because that's basically like he's got one more page within this historical background. We're now going to look at the causes of war. There's very kind of shades of, you know, the way that Thucydides is interpreted by some of our field, like, you know, okay, now that we've gone through the real causes, let's run through all of those other causes. He starts out with the Triple Alliance, and there the argument is that you essentially are looking at a security dilemma. The drawing together of the powers of the Entente, this is on page 20, did in fact appear to Germany as a menace. She believed that she was being threatened by an aggressive combination, just as on the other hand, she herself seemed to be the powers of the Entente a danger to be guarded.
Right. One of the nice things about this historical account that Dickinson gives is he really skewers the idea that anybody is the aggressor. He says, no, because from each different side, people are going to view moves as aggressive. And it's really not, it's not as if you could somehow lock down and figure out who actually was the aggressor. It's really not the fault of that. It's actually the fault of this broader distrust, this broader set of power competition logics. And any moment where two states are, or multiple states are, rivals, they're going to start characterizing each other in the worst possible terms. So you can't really trust any official view of another state, because of course they're going to be characterizing the other as the aggressor, because nobody, it says at one point, like, nobody ever actually says we're engaged in aggressive war. It's always defensive. And back to some of our original impetus for thinking about this, certainly both Russia and Ukraine characterize themselves as effectively reacting rather than initiating. So you get this sort of this repetition of these same kinds of dynamics. Everybody wants to be on the side of we're just defensive. Nobody actually wants to say we're the aggressor. But Dickinson points out you can't, trying to look for the aggressor is never the right way to try to figure out why there's a war.
Yeah, I mean, he does, if I remember correctly, he does kind of apportion more responsibility to Germany.
There's a little bit. There's a little bit of the, well, sure, in this instance, the Germans did this, but you have to remember the big backdrop. So he always goes back to the bigger picture.
Even within that, he is full of what we call strategic empathy. That is to say that he says, but from their point of view, it looks kind of different. What I do think is interesting about the next section, and so these early sections are very short, which is on Great Britain, is that he repeats this claim about, you know, which is the very standard story, right? Offshore balancing. We did it not because we were nice, but it was in our interests. But he does kind of point out that it is interesting and a little unusual that Britain is maintaining anarchy on the continent to facilitate imperialism elsewhere. Because usually empires are just trying to imperialize, mm-hmm. period. And that,
right.
He says, we claim, therefore, that we have neither the need nor the desire to wage wars of conquest. And the reason we claim that, he says, is because we've basically reached our maximal administrative extent. So we kind of have gotten as big as we can get. And then we say, well, that proves we're peaceful, that we're not expanding. And he says, you know, they kind of look at us rightfully as really, really aggressive and expansionist, because that's what we've been up to. And he lists a bunch of places where, you know, that's been going on.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Odd as it does, I believe, genuinely seem to most Englishmen, we are regarded on the continent as the most aggressive power in the world. So our desire for peace is genuine, but it doesn't make us like morally superior. We want peace so we can be dominant.
There is, to the extent that there's a moral calculus in Dickinson's worldview when it comes to thinking about international relations, it's certainly not that any country stands on the side of morality. It is the elites are acting immorally. He says in the 1914 Atlantic Peace, he has that great line about it's against common human decency to do the kinds of things that our elites are presently involved in. But the people have a better version of these things. And so the moral judgment here is not that any state is in the right, but that the broad masses of the public, the view of peoples is no domination, he says, right? And therefore no war, but a union of nations developing freely on their own lines and settling all disputes by arbitration. So that's the moral calculus. He's really good at skewering the claims to moral superiority of any country involved in the conflict, which of course, if one goes back and looks at the history of public relations during World War One, all of that stuff is trying to characterize the other as spawn of Satan. And Dickens is like, no, that's not actually what's going on here. That's not, we should not be playing that game. We should be realizing that it's all part of what he elsewhere calls the European
tradition. He just runs through us largely country by country for a while, focuses on French chauvinism. He quotes French analysts, politicians, Frenchmen anyway, discussing just how chauvinist France is and bemoaning it as a way of demonstrating its chauvinism. He has some not very nice things to say about Russia. He mentions that they have, because they've always looked to Germany, they've inherited the German contempt, you know, the German bureaucratic contempt and hatred for liberty and democracy. And he talks about Austria-Hungary. I do think what's interesting, the one thing that I think is notable in the discussion of Austria-Hungary is that my sense about the mood right now concerning Austria-Hungary is that there is a kind of mounting revisionist position that says that Austria-Hungary was a good thing. And in part, this is hindsight, right, that you see the results of the kinds of conflicts that emerge in the wake of Hungary. But I also think there's something, this actually comes out in part of the Austrian school of the neoliberal tradition. There's a kind of understanding of the federative character of Austria-Hungary as being potentially laudable. You know, the fact that, you know, you could have different, by World War I, you definitely had the encouragement of a lot of nationalities. There's a reason why Ukrainian as a language persists in the regions it does, which is, but he is very, this is not his worldview. And you can writes on page 38, right after he introduces Austria-Hungary, he writes, Austria-Hungary is a state, but not a nation, has no natural bond to hold its population together. And it continues its political existence by force and fraud, by the connivance and the self-interest of other states, rather than by any inherent principle of vitality. And then it's in relation to the Balkan states that this has been dangerous. And he goes on to say that this is all like made everything worse, basically. this is, I think, gives you a sense of why Austria-Hungary is, the first on the chopping block.
Yeah. Well, and there's also a strong sense in Dickinson, which is part of that whole sort of Wilsonian liberal tradition, that nations naturally belong together. And if you just give them plebiscites, then people will choose to be together and be ruled by themselves and their own people. So there's this very strong naturalization of national communities, which, of course, doesn't work because national communities disagree about who constitutes the nation. And so you end up with problems there. But for the argument here, right, what Austria-Hungary can't work because it's this polyglot of people not being ruled by their own nationals. And so for him, the stable situation is cut all of these things up into small groups and let people rule themselves. So that becomes the kind of naturalized version that's the alternative to this world of state sovereignty.
Part of this is the period, right? National identity is fairly naturalized. And we're living in an era of national self-determination movements where these are gathering steam, both in Europe, and they will gather a lot of steam over the next few years outside of Europe. And so it's not surprising that you would have this equation of democratic self-rule with national self-determination. And that's a very old formula.
And as an immediate backdrop, right, he's also writing some of this stuff in the period where, 1914, the British government has passed home rule bills for Scotland and Ireland.
He talks about this in The Causes of International War. When he's talking about this idea that nations haven't voluntarily relinquished sovereignty, he says, well, we've done it for the Dominion, but they were never really precisely our subjects in the same way, right? And he says, look, we haven't done it for Ireland yet. And he says, there's some hope that Labour might do it, but other than that, there's no will. When does Ireland actually get independent?
It depends on who you ask, right? You have the Easter Rising in 1916, and you have the war, and you end up with different proclamations of Irish independence at different times. If you ask a straight Irish nationalist, and Ireland still isn't independent because six counties are still under imperial occupation. So,
okay, if you're British, if you're the British government, how does this work?
When is the, gosh, I forget the exact date, when it is that the Irish Republic actually, so it's in the 20s someplace, 22, Anglo-Irish Treaty is 22. So now, as early as 1914, which is when the first Home Rule Bill is passed and then is suspended for the duration of the war, same with the Scottish Home Rule Bill, Dickinson is very happy about this in that 1914 piece where he talks about, yes, we've now, England has now finally done this. They finally created, they've allowed the sort of national self-determination for the Irish and the Scottish. But then he actually says at that point, it still remains for us to do, for Britain to do the most important thing, which is do it for India. So even in 1914, he's sort of thinking along these lines.
I can't remember which book it's in, but he even uses language like having the courage to do this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so clearly for him, there's a moral imperative here that is being thwarted by pecuniary interest.
In the 1914 Atlantic piece, let no community be coerced under British rule that wants to be self-governing. The British have had the courage, though late, to apply this principle to South Africa and to Ireland. There remains their greatest act of courage and wisdom to apply it to India. So hasn't happened yet, but he's clearly, he has the courage of his convictions in terms of the argument being that nations should have plebiscites and should rule themselves. Even if that means dismantling parts of the British dominions, then go for it, right? That's what needs to happen, because that's how you get peace, because you have democratic control over these things.
So well, there's some interesting things in his discussion of Germany.
Mm.
One of them is that he laments the fact that Germany was unified in 1870 under Prussia, not in 1848, in a democratic revolution.
Uh-huh.
And he says, if the free and generous idealism of that epoch could have triumphed as it deserved to, Germans had not bartered away their souls for the sake of the kingdom of this world, we might have been spared this last and most terrible act in the bloody drama.
Yeah.
This is actually kind of gets at the ambiguity or the ambivalence of his position on some of these matters. So in 41, he talks about how the spirit of Bismarck has infected the whole public life of Germany and of Europe. It has given a new lease to the political philosophy of Machiavelli, made of every budding statesman and historian a solemn or cynical defender of the gospel. Of course, he's very critical, the Ems dot telegram. He does this on, he accomplishes this war on a lie, and that's just the height of Machiavelli.
Mm-hmm.
Then he says, but though this be true, we have no right, therefore, to assume that there is some peculiar wickedness which marks off German policy from that of other nations.
Right.
Politicians, publicists, and historians in every nation accept it under a thicker or thinner veil of plausible sophism.
Yeah.
Is everywhere the iron hand within the silken glove. It is the great European tradition.
Exactly, exactly. You should imagine the kind of sneer when he says that, the great European tradition. But he also points out with some of his other stuff on Germany, when he's in the specific taking apart of different kinds of German policies, he points out that any of these characterizations of the war as having resulted from something in the German attitude or the German character are problematic because, as he says at one point during one of those chapters, how misleading it really is to talk of Germany and the German attitude. There is every kind of German attitude. And of course, we read, I'm not quoting here, I'm just running the argument. Of course, we read certain things and call them the German attitude because we are characterizing them in ways that legitimate our military opposition to them. So he has a very nuanced view of how easily characterizations of others are affected by this very same competitive anarchy dynamic. And he wants to get past that. So again, we're not talking about moral narratives. We're not talking about national character. You can see in this exactly what kind of arguments he's trying to refute about, well, no, these are not really the important things that we should be dealing with here. There are real problems, which largely involve the lack of democracy, the lack of popular accountability. And if we just had those, right, then we would end up with something that was much more peaceful.
The Germany section here can be a little bit difficult because he spends a lot of time running through the argument about, the defects of the German spirit before,
mm-hmm.
Caveating it pretty heavily. But it's important, he says that, look, the mistake here is that people are reading wartime propaganda by the German jingos.
Right.
And they're mistaking that for all of Germany, and that this is really a minority position that has run rampant as a result of the conflict. And there we have this, what's important to him is that this has to be a kind of minority that can capture politics, because if it isn't, then a league isn't possible.
Right.
If you can't act or practice or cooperate your way out of anarchy, if it's the case that it's not possible to get a majority public sentiment behind it.
Right. And that, again, back to that that Ninkovich argument, right? That a lot of the U.S. post-war settlement 20th century reformist notions have to do with this, can't call it anything but faith in what the people want. The faith that public opinion is different than what is being portrayed, and it's really just these corrupt leaders or these ambitious leaders that are kind of manipulating the public. And that can't actually be what people want, because if it really was, then the whole argument that you could somehow dismiss this system by increasing popular participation would just fall apart. So you need that leap of faith, that kind of confidence in advance of the facts, in which you would say, no, people don't really want this. People want something else. And that is integral to the structure of the argument. There's a line, and I keep going back to that 1914 Atlantic piece just because it's such a
crisp,
sparkling piece. But near the end of that, he has this great, sort of the moral test that he gives the reader. Let the reader practice and pursue that method in dealing with every book and every press article that he comes across in which this fallacy is maintained. That's the fallacy of the moral justifications for war. Let him ask himself always, when there is talk of power, of prestige, of markets, of expansion, and all the other shibboleths, what exactly do these things mean in terms of the life of men and women? And if sometimes he detects among the objects aimed at by governments one that seems to imply a real benefit to real people, then let him ask himself, is it tolerable for a decent human being to pursue this advantage at the cost of other human beings by means of war, as has now been freshly and vividly revealed to me? So there's a real humanistic faith here in something like decency, something like a common human standard that isn't articulated in an exact kind of legal code, but some notion that decent people would be horrified by, oh, we're just going to wage war to go out and gain resources. Like, no, we shouldn't do that. That's not the sort of thing that like decent people do. We don't go and just do this. So we should be stepping back. We should be thinking about different ways of doing this. There is a great amount of confidence in that kind of public spiritedness of the public, I think, which is, to wind this back to something we've been talking about throughout here, is a very traditional liberal assumption about politics and about everyday rationality, to which this whole Machiavellian tradition is then shown to be a deviation, right? And you can get rid of that if you just let this other stuff flower up, and that's what we really need.
And if you want to think about the bulk of the rest of the European anarchy, we could go through it blow by blow, but it essentially is in the spirit of saying, you know, the British were right to be skeptical of the Germans, but the Germans were also right to be skeptical of the British because of the international anarchy. Because of the European tradition. And he says, you know, I would not advocate that Britain, any power, disarm as long as this tradition reigned, because then, you know, it would be suicide. You don't [S2] Right. [S1] Want to do that. But you can understand how both sides would think that the other was a spoiler, or, you know, why, you know, the kind of claim, well, why would you fear this if you didn't want war? Well, the Germans can turn around and say the same thing to us. So essentially, there's a very long, detailed account of this in German-British-German-French relations. He runs through a lot of the key moments. He talks about the fight over German rail in Mesopotamia. He talks about disputes over African territory.
And I think, again, what I find kind of interesting with this work and with his work generally as a kind of historical document is he's spending so much time on these things because he's combating the popular arguments of the day, that so many of these things are being kind of characterized in moral terms. And he's not having any of it, right? He definitely does not want to allow any narrative of somebody was justified to be circulating here. Instead, it's, this is the kind of thing that's going to happen again and again in the course of things, as long as we adhere to this European tradition, this Machiavellianism. So the only thing you can do is really get rid of it. And that's where we get the proposals for something like the League, something like democratic control of foreign policy, that would be a way of getting past this. And then you would simply practice a different kind of politics. And you could do that through, I think, sort of two levels of democratic control. You've got the plebiscites about nations belonging together, so nations are able to kind of rule themselves. And then you've got a rethinking of foreign policy as being not about claims for competitive claims for resources, but about mutual solutions of problems. So it's a kind of global democracy that comes into this. And so to go back to one of our earlier bits, it just baffles me that anybody could think that this was a realist argument, even though I could see if we recognize that realists are just pessimistic liberals, okay, that makes an awful lot of sense, that they just basically buy the account, they don't buy the optimism of a solution. But this is liberal through and through.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, I want to read you one of my favorite examples of that, which is on page 120, when he gets around to finally saying, well, what does he really think about responsibility for war? And this is where it kind of comes down on, you know, well, Germany, Austria-Hungary, and, you know, have the responsibility for the actual outbreak, even though the war itself is caused by these ordering structural traditions, whatever you want to call it, the international anarchy. He is talking about the argument that the Kaiser changed his mind at this pivotal moment, and the claim that's circulating at that period that this is really important. Mm-hmm. Essentially, it went from peace to war. So he says, by this time, quite clearly, Austria was backed by Germany. Why this change in German policy? So far as the Kaiser himself is concerned, there can be little doubt that a main cause was the horror he felt at the assassination of the Archduke. The absurd system of autocracy gives to the emotional reactions of an individual a preposterous weight in determining world policy. The almost insane feelings of the Kaiser about the sanctity of crowned heads was no doubt a main reason why Germany backed Austria in sending her ultimatum to Syria.
Yep.
So there's not a lot of ambiguity there about what he thinks about authoritarian governments and autocratic governments.
Right.
What we now call personalist regimes, although Germany's personalism is more complicated.
I don't know. I have a kind of an inchoate thought about contemporary parallels, but
it's not inchoate, right? I mean, there's one of the major arguments about how we get to the war on Ukraine is that Putin sees Gaddafi dragged to his death. Besides, this ain't going to happen in Syria. And that's part of the Syrian intervention. And this is part of the road that gets us where we are today. And so you both have this element of Putin standing up for other autocrats because he worries about being in that position. He imagines himself being the one who's being. But also the degree that the Ukraine war seems to have turned on, you know, his personal feelings at the time about this, that, or the other thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The more things change, the more they stay the same, et cetera, et cetera, right?
Et cetera, et cetera.
Then the final chapter is called The Change Needed. Mm-hmm. 18 is the settlement, 19 is the change needed.
Yes.
In 18, at least, is a distillation of what's gone on before, kind of continuation of what he's been saying in the section on Germany, how Germany might have proximate responsibility, but they thought they were fighting a preventative war, and we need to understand that. Mm. This is where I think the realist interpretation gets funky, right, is in 19. And this is, I think, what you have in mind when you keep on saying this is not what you think it is.
Right.
19 is called The Change Needed. The very first sentence is, first, a change of outlook. We must give up in all nations this habit of dwelling on the unique and peculiar wickedness of the enemy. We must recognize that behind the acts that led up to the immediate outbreak of war, behind the crimes and atrocities this war has led, as wars always have led and always will lead, behind all that lies a great complex of feeling, prejudice, tradition, false theory, in which all nations and all individuals of all nations are involved. So we need a change of attitude.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's even right below that, right? He goes on to sort of, what is it? Most men feel, believe, or passively accept that power and wealth are the objects states ought to pursue, and that pursuing these objects, they're bound by no code of right in their relations to one another, and that law between them is as fragile as a cobweb stretched before the mouth of a cannon, that force is the only rule. So these are changeable attitudes that he blames, but doesn't think they're hardwired into either human nature or some parametric organizing principle of international politics per se.
Yeah, I mean, it is a little bit hard to parse out because he, on the one hand, he does think that the anarchy, the state of nature of international politics, gives rise as a natural corollary to Machiavellianism, that is to power politics,
mm-hmm.
and to expansionism and greed, et cetera, et cetera. Let's that run wild. But on the other hand, he also thinks that Machiavellianism is a kind of mythology. You know, it's not right.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tradition and a bad one.
And on a couple of paragraphs further down, when he's talking about exactly what's needed to effect this change, he says, in constructing machinery of this kind, and he means league-type machinery for international coordination and use of force, there is no intellectual difficulty greater than that which has confronted every attempt everywhere to substitute order for force. The difficulty is moral and lies in the habits, passions, and wills of men.
And you know what is the example of how it's possible to do this?
Mm-hmm.
It's the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever new need, desire, and conviction comes up in mankind needs embodiment and forms before it can become operative. As the separate colonies of America could not effectively unite until they had formed a constitution, so will the states of Europe and the world be unable to maintain the peace, even though all of them should wish to maintain it, unless they will construct some kind of machinery for settling their disputes and organizing their common purpose, and will back that machinery by force. If they will do that, then they may construct a real and effective counterpoise to aggression from any power in the future.
And the note I have scribbled in the margin there is two words, the word negarchy and the word Dewdney. Because, of course, this is Dan Dewdney's argument about the what he calls the Philadelphian Republic, that the early stages of the United States really is an institutional effort to beat back anarchy and organize things differently. So very reminiscent of the same kind of argument. Though, of course, what he's talking about here, what Dickinson is talking about here, is much more universal, right? It's not we should have a United States of Europe. It's we should have a League of Nations that's sort of global, right? That should include all these things.
Although apparently, according to some online sources, I can't remember, his writings, and particularly a book that I think neither of us wound up reading, but what, The Choice Before Us, some people argue that did influence thinking about the formation of the European community.
Hmm.
So, I mean, there is a way you can read this as, you know, particular. That's not what he wants,
right?
But I think he would also find that preferable to nothing at all.
Yeah, no, I agree.
So I'm still struck by this idea that really the fight is between liberal pessimists and liberal optimists, right?
Mm-hmm.
People who say you're not going to be able to get the chicken and egg problem worked out. There are going to be too many barriers to that happening. And so, you know, there are going to be very restricted conditions under which you can escape from the state of nature. And those conditions are going to be things like what happened with the European Union, which is U.S. provision of security. Effectively being already kind of out of the state of nature anyway,
mm-hmm.
or enough out of it that you can go further. And I think even, I don't know, I mean, are realists skeptical of the EU, or they kind of reconciled themselves to it?
I don't have a good sense of that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, because of course the argument that immediately leaps to mind is the Mearsheimer Back to the Future argument, but I don't know how Mearsheimer can be an outlier on a number of these things. I don't know, but whether your sort of modal realist has now accepted the EU.
So my big concern about these kinds of debates is the, you know, in the long run clause.
Yeah.
So, and this is why I said I'm not sure the League of Nations failed. I just don't think it succeeded as well as it needed to. Eventually, the EU will collapse. Eventually, the United States will collapse. We don't know when. Probably, I hope not in the immediate term, but you know, nothing lasts forever. This is Rousseau's basic point. No political community lasts forever.
Right.
And the fact that it, at some point, things change, as they always will, is not evidence that they didn't, in essence, that they never happened, which is the way that I think a lot of these arguments play out. Well, it was inevitable that we were going to return to anarchy. Yeah, it was inevitable because change is inevitable.
Yeah.
It doesn't negate, right, that period of durable cooperation, or that period of confederative political association.
Mm-hmm.
So I get kind of frustrated with these takes. A long time ago, Ron wrote a reply in Security Studies, Ron Krebs, where he basically said, you know, we need to get past this. We need to start having you know, if we're going to be realists, we should have realist and power political theories that incorporate institutions, incorporate things like the EU, rather than just kind of spend our entire time trying to deny that they're having any effect on international politics.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things I've been reading as sabbatical reading, because blissfully I'm on sabbatical, has been Graeber and Wengrow's The Dawn of Everything, which is a fascinating book. And because they are operating with these archaeological timescales of thousands of years, one of their basic points is that if you look at what we understand of the history of humanity, it goes through a whole bunch of different periods with a lot of different things happening. And so treating any of these things as permanent is problematic, because it seems like, at least as far as the archaeological record tells us, that the one thing you can say about the history of human social and political organization is we experiment with a whole lot of different forms at different times, and we combine things in all sorts of different ways. So any arrangement would on that scale be temporary. And these claims that somehow one or another theory has unearthed the master key just strikes me as deeply problematic, particularly when it's a group of elite white people saying that our way of organizing the world is of permanent value over everybody else.
So I guess one last thing about the readings proper is there is the European anarchy, but there is also a longer extended version of the argument, an extended mix, which is called the International Anarchy, 1904 to 1914. And to some degree, I think if you're going to go out and read one of them, I would read that one, not the European Anarchy.
Mm-hmm.
It's more detailed. It's a little bit, it's less rushed, at least in the way it reads. And there are some things there that are really come forward that are, I think, not as well signposted or even as explicit or even necessarily there in the European Anarchy. For example, very early on in section 2 of chapter 1 of the International Anarchy, he is very critical of the balance of power. Essentially, balance of power is not going to bring peace, right? It doesn't work. The positions thus illustrated bring us at once to the fatal defect of the balance of power. As a distinguished historian has wittily put it, the word balance has two meanings. It means, on the one hand, equality, as of the two sides when the account is balanced. And on the other hand, an inequality, so when one has a balanced one's credit at the bank. The balance of power theory professes the former, but pursues the latter. It is thus, in fact, a perpetual effort to get the better of the balance. As this effort is prosecuted on both sides, the ultimate issue is war. All history shows this, for every balance has ended in war. This could be read as a kind of offensive realist Scopenian position. And there are ways in which it's consistent, because he does think that you can get peace under hegemony, under empire. It's a bad peace, but you can get peace that way.
Mm-hmm.
But the balance of power is fragile. This is Gilpin's position. Oligarchic copulation is more difficult than monopoly. But, you know, if you think about him kind of in the structural realist event, this is a departure. Let me rephrase that. This is fundamentally like it could be read as offensive realist, but it's fundamentally a very liberal position. This is the liberal critique of the balance of power has always been. I'm using liberal in this broad sense to include people we now think of as left liberals or socialists or whatever, which has always viewed the balance of power as corrupt, as being a mechanism for war.
Right.
Has always been deeply skeptical of the kind of power political defense of the balance of power.
Oh, yeah. All these sort of these various dynamics of what happens when everybody is pursuing this kind of Machiavellian tradition. He's very, very astute on that. But, and I'm not going to suggest that anybody of our listeners, ordinary folks who are international studies folks, go out and read Dickinson's collection of essays called Religion, A Criticism and a Forecast. But I think there is something important about the way we've characterized IR realists as kind of pessimistic liberals. It stands to reason then that they're optimistic liberals, and where does Dickinson's optimism come from? And Dickinson's optimism comes from this faith. But the way he defines faith is really interesting, and it's not doctrinal. He says, faith is an attitude of what I might call active expectancy. The attitude of a man who, while candidly recognizing that he does not know and faithfully pursuing or awaiting knowledge, is ready to accept it when it comes, yet centers meantime his emotional and therefore his practical life about a possibility which he selects because of its value, its desirability. And in that particular set of essays, Dickinson isn't talking about international politics at all, but I think there's a constancy of his own attitude that you can see there. He wouldn't say, right, I know that there can be a league, but he would say, I have faith in the goodness of humanity that we could produce something like this. And now I'm going to orient myself toward trying to make that happen. And that, I think, is where you get your difference between more optimistic liberals and the more pessimistic liberals who would accept the diagnosis, but then say, but there's nothing we can do about it. And Dickinson clearly says, no, there is something we can do about it. And this is what we can do. And we can engage in these acts, which are much more faith-based optimism than direct derivations from empirics, but then we can build ourselves something a little bit better. So since we've been talking about this in terms of a split between realists and liberals, I would almost say there is something of a constructivist-y strain to Dickinson as well.
And you get that, I mean, for example, in The International Anarchy, he has a section on the motives of aggression. And he says that it's not only inertia, habit, professional interests which stand in the way of disarmament. It's something else. Always some state, and usually many states, desire something that is only to be had by war. Yeah. And in his discussion of that, there's a lot of kind of nuanced stuff about, you know, aggressive versus defensive and the kinds of things we've heard before. But he has this kind of amazingly snide discussion of the pans, as he calls them.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of going on about this greed, you know, acquisition. And what's interesting, and you know, take it while you is, he describes these as the realistic motives.
Right.
These kinds of reasons for aggressive expansion have a realistic justification. The objects, that is, are intelligible. Granted, the anarchy of international relations, the desire of states to exploit their neighbors to their own advantage. But behind these causes of war, which may be called realities, there lies something less amenable to rational discussion. That something is the passion, possessing always some individuals, incapable of seizing at times and places whole masses of men for size and power as the good and desirable thing for its own sake. It's not useful to argue about this passion, for it is independent of reasons, so that if these are given at all, they are given by a way of dialectics to push the opponent, if possible, by hook or by crook, out of the way. The feeling in question may therefore be called mystical, if by that word we describe a position for which no reasoned defense can be made, and it must be admitted that the greater part of human conduct is of that kind. In literature and journalism, this blind impulse is often signified by the Greek word pan. Men speak of pan-Slavism, pan-Germanism, pan-Americanism. If we do not use it in the sense the word pan-Anglicanism, we may have the simpler phrase with the same meaning, all red. Red, it may be remarked in passing, is not only the color in which the British Empire is painted, it is also the color of blood. The kind of excitement symbolized by such words as these shows the unreflecting and primitive nature of the mood, is in fact the lust for power raised to its highest point and unrestrained by any sense, either of fact or value. And then he goes on to talk about a Russian memoir. We're discussing outbursts of Slavophilism.
Right.
In that same way.
So. No, and again, that goes back to this liberal genteel, no, we can progress from these sorts of base impulses. We can move on. And maybe if not everybody can, certainly the masses of people can, and it's just the horrible, rapacious elites that need to be kind of gotten rid of in order to bring us into something else. So there is optimism, there is faith about what humanity can be if it tosses those things off. And then the question is whether we actually think people can toss those things off. And that goes back to this pessimism, optimism, or as we've phrased it in some of our other writings, the question of whether you can transcend power politics or not. And on that ground, I think it's pretty clear that Dickinson, even if his later writings get a little more skeptical of how easy this will be to do, is clearly on the side of saying, no, we can do this. We can do this. We should do this. We have to do this because it's the only way we're actually going to solve the problem. I
mean, fundamentally, the reason for war is anarchy. Anarchy produces all of those effects that we're very used to from standard, smaller, realist international relations theory. But that's why we can do away with war.
Exactly.
That's
exactly.
You know, if we play our cards right, if we educate people, if we agitate, we find the moment, we can form an international political system based on democracy, law, and equality.
Yeah. And that's it. That's the core, I think, of what Dickinson is advocating.
Yeah, I mean, so I think your reference, I mean, as much as I get uncomfortable with the isms, although I talk about realism all the time, because realists call themselves realists, and they're like one of the few people left who are like, we are a school. But that aside, constructivism is an apt metaphor here in the sense that agents can overcome structures for
him. Oh, absolutely.
That everything that we associate with realism is true, except for that the European anarchy is a social product, social construct, which is capable of being remade, refashioned.
Yeah. Anarchy is what the European states made of it under the tutelage of Machiavelli.
Even if there are certain feedback effects that can make it difficult, even if there are certain interests that get in your way, even if there are certain mystical passions that raise problems.
And that's the punchline for him. So
yeah, it was interesting stuff, I think.
Yeah, good stuff. Good stuff. All right.
Okay. So
I think we're good. I think we're good.
Yeah, I think we are good.
I'm going to stop the recording here on my end. I will send you that.
Well, actually, before you stop it, you should say goodbye. Say goodbye, Patrick.
Oh. Goodbye, Dan. This was a lot of fun. It was good that we finally got a chance to do this. The next time, we should do this in person, since now we can, because the pandemic has moved to that phase.
Yeah, you were supposed to say goodbye, Patrick, by the way.
Was I?
Yeah, you were.
Okay. Well, then let me say that so you can paste it back in. So I'll say goodbye, Patrick.
Patrick. Whatever. Okay, all right. And they should all be this short.
Yes.
So
they should be. All right. Okay. Dinner's upstairs, so I'm going.
See you later.